Desperate Afghan refugees. They say EU countries helped to create this latest refugee crisis, but are now closing their borders.
As long as we have people having to fly their home, go and be in either refugee camps or shelter where when it's available, we're not doing enough.
Regarding HERA, the point has also been made that the EU is inviting new health crises to the bloc by not sharing its huge stockpile of vaccines to poorer countries, mitigating the risk of new COVID-19 variants. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
Abdul Malik, who had never so much as belonged to a political party or group, was looted of what he had saved for his family, tortured and shot to death by soldiers wearing the uniform of and receiving their salary from Abu Dhabi, says Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist, in an article titled Grief and Anger After UAE Soldiers Torture and Kill Yemeni American Student Trying to Visit Family. Stay tuned for more. As his hope that the Sana'a International Airport will be reopened has faded, smiley-faced Abdul Malik Anwar Al-Sanabani, a 25-year-old Yemeni-American living in Fresno, California, finally decided to take the risky journey across the south of Yemen in order to see his family in Sana'a. Al-Sanabani had gone 8 years away from his loved ones. Recently, he arrived at southern Yemen's Aden Airport, where he shared his last Facebook post before his smiley face became bloodied and bruised. Abdul Malik, a graduate of Huntsville Community College, was not kidnapped, imprisoned, and tortured like the thousands of Yemeni students traveling through Saudi-controlled points of entry have been. Rather, he was robbed, tortured, and murdered at a checkpoint in the Tor al-Baha district in northern Lahej province by the security belt forces of Transitional Council, an armed militant group backed by the United Arab Emirates. Abdul Malik's father recounted to Mint Press that we were in constant contact with Abdul Malik during his trip before communication was cut on Wednesday afternoon. Later, his family was surprised when media outlets and statements by officials affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition in Tor al-Baha began reporting the arrest of their son possessing sums of money. His father said, "We quickly traveled to Aden but were shocked to find his dead body in the morgue of the Republican Hospital in Aden after he had been tortured and killed." Abdul Malik's body was full of bruises and wounds, indicating that he had been tortured. There were also 3 bullet entry wounds in his back and a 4th in his leg, according to Al-Sanabani family. Abdul Malik, who had never so much as belonged to a political party or group, was looted of what he had saved for his family, tortured and killed by gunshots by soldiers wearing the uniform of and receiving their salary from Abu Dhabi. He committed no crime, but Abdul Malik was not the only one to meet such a fate because of the region from which he hailed, his sect or his family. Recently, 4 students, Hussam Tariq Al-Shaybani, Ibrahim Ahmad Al-Shahari, Ahmad Moin Al-Madani and Yahya Mansour Al-Araghi, were kidnapped when they arrived at Aden Airport. Their families told Min Press News that their fate is still unknown, a fact confirmed by the General Union of Yemeni Students in Malaysia, which issued a statement in the wake of the disappearance. Since 2015, when the Saudi war, supported by the United States and other Western military powers, transformed this nation on the Arabian Peninsula into a large prison for millions of Yemenis, students studying abroad along with stranded medical patients and expatriates have had only this option to return home, either across Al-Mahra, Siun in the east, or Aden in the south, all routes that pass through Lahej, Shabwa and Ma'arib, areas under Saudi-led coalition control. As soon as they arrive at these places, militants affiliated with Saudi Arabia or the UAE check their identities. If they live in provinces, cities, streets, or even neighborhoods that are classified as a hotbed for Ansarullah, or if they belong to certain Yemeni families or are affiliated with a Shia Muslim sect, they are often arrested, tortured, and imprisoned. The lives of Abdul Malik and four other students have touched the hearts of Yemenis across the political and religious divide and sparked an uproar inside the country and abroad. In the United States, hundreds of Yemeni expatriates took to the streets in Michigan, California, and New York. Protesters condemned the crime and held the UAE responsible, calling for the Sana'a International Airport to be reopened so that Yemenis can travel safely without the risk of imprisonment, torture, and death. In Yemen, dozens of protests were held, mostly in northern provinces, but the largest demonstration was in Abdul Malik's hometown of Dhamar, a city in southwestern Yemen. There, many of his relatives who spoke to Min Press News accused both the Biden administration and the UAE of murdering a family member and U.S. citizen. If the Sana'a airport was open, Abdul Malik would now live in peace. We know, in fact, that the airport siege is supported by America. Hani Al-Sanabani, one of Abdul Malik's relatives, told Min Press News in the wake of a protest that took place in Sanaban. Abdul Malik's death has also triggered condemnation from nearly all Yemeni political parties, human rights organizations, activists, journalists, lawyers, and members of the Yemeni community in the United States. The closure of the Sana'a airport and the imposition of an air embargo have exacerbated the humanitarian situation for many civilians both inside and outside the country. With the continued absence of safe corridors, many stranded students, patients, and professionals recently deported from Saudi Arabia are left in a state of legal limbo, unable to secure citizenship in neighboring countries and therefore unable to work, leaving them with no way to earn money short of begging on the street or agreeing to sell their organs. In 2018, Musa Al-Izaki, the editor of Yemen's widely circulated Al-Hayat newspaper, made a very public offer to sell one of his kidneys to the highest bidder. Al-Izaki coordinated with his brother, who was living in Egypt at the time, to place an ad in a Cairo newspaper with the caption, "Under compelling circumstances, I regret to announce the sale of my kidney to pay rent. If someone wants to buy a kidney, please call me." It's unknown if Al-Izaki ever found a buyer. Since 2015, the Saudi bombing of civilians and infrastructure and the imprisonment and torture of political opponents have often characterized the news from Yemen. But the imprisonment of students in secret prisons supervised and managed by both the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, a fact that is well known and likely supported by the United States regime, may be the darkest chapter in this dirty war. the death of Abdul-Malik and other students have again sparked concerns among millions of Yemenis, particularly expatriates, students, and medical patients stranded abroad, about the unchecked violence carried out by the Saudi-led coalition in their country. The incidents further highlighted the dangers faced by Yemenis seeking to travel across the country in dangerous circumstances and the role of the United States in the ongoing suffering of Yemenis who struggle against starvation, epidemics, and bombing. It is estimated that nearly 4 million Yemenis are currently stranded abroad, according to data provided by the Sana'a International Airport Media Center.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the newsline.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, has approved documents for Iran's full membership at the Eurasian Political, Economic, and Security Alliance. The decision came as the 21st summit of the organization opened in Dushanbe earlier in the day. The Islamic Republic joined the SCO in 2005 as an observer state.
SCO, with the current membership, covers close to 50% of the world population and about one-third of the world's GDP. Being a member of this organization will take a lot of pressure away in terms of Western sanctions, Western impositions, monetary manipulations via the US dollar as a remedy for payment. No more.
Leaders from 8 member states and 4 observer states attended the annual summit in Tajikistan's capital on Friday, with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping addressing it virtually along with Russian president. Xi criticized sanctions imposed on world economic exchanges, urging the SCO members to stay united against attacks by other countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his counterpart from Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan attended in person. Addressing the summit, President Raisi said the world today has entered a new era when hegemony and unilateralism are declining.
The world is entering a new era with a new order. Domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
The Iranian president also underlined that sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. In his address at the SCO summit, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi described sanctions as economic terrorism and the hegemonic power's most important tool to impose their own will on the others. He warned that unilateral sanctions are not limited to one country, but as it has become clear in recent years, they include more independent countries, particularly the SCO member states. Two key members of the alliance, Russia and China, have also come under sanctions from the West. Ties between Washington and Beijing deteriorated after former U.S. President Donald Trump took office in 2017, waging an economic war against China. While many expected the current administration of Joe Biden to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies, it adopted a tougher stance against China and Russia, imposing several rounds of sanctions on them on various pretexts.
Western trade currency restrictions do not exist in the SCO member countries. This will drastically reduce the potential for Western sanctions and will increase, on the other hand, Iran's potential to deal with the East, for example, or especially China and Russia, entering partnership agreements with these and other SCO countries, benefiting from comparative advantages.
At the end of the summit, SCO member states signed the Dushanbe Declaration, in which they stress opposition to interference under the excuse of counterterrorism or human rights, or solving key international and regional issues through small cliques, ideology, or confrontation mentality. They also agreed on strengthening cooperation in cracking down on terrorism, extremism, and separatism, and reached a consensus in supporting building an inclusive government in Afghanistan.
The Israel regime has reportedly started a cyber sabotage campaign in the UAE to interfere with the regional air and maritime navigation in West Asia.
Cyber warfare is becoming more and more important and more dangerous as well. So Israel wants to take advantage of any opportunities there.
The campaign seeks to disrupt the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman region's air and maritime navigation systems, thus destabilizing the regional security situation. On the other hand, the bid seeks to transit the focal point of crisis away from the occupied territories towards the region and therefore reduce the political and security pressure faced by the regime's ruling body. The UAE has signed dozens of memorandums of understanding with Israel since it became the first Arab state to normalize ties with Israel this century.
Israel sees itself with the Sunni monarchies and the conservatives as their potential allies in this. So it wants to be able to conduct the kind of cyber sabotage and infiltration that is becoming so important, so much more important. So it's not surprising that they would do this when they have the opportunity, and the UAE is providing that opportunity for them.
Israel has said that it expects $1 billion in trade with the UAE by the end of 2021 and $3 billion in 3 years. The UAE aims to raise the value of economic activity with Israel to more than $1 trillion in the next 10 years. According to regional observers, at the heart of the UAE's desire to normalize ties with the regime in Tel Aviv was his penchant for U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets, which the peace deals with Israel, known as the Abraham Accords, made possible. To the Persian Gulf state, established full diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime in a deal brokered by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. Shortly after the deal was reached, the Trump administration authorized the sale of 50 advanced F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. The UAE and Israel are reportedly deepening their ties and espionage activities in the region. The UAE has helped Israel set up a center for military and maritime reconnaissance on the strategic Yemeni island of Socotra. The Red Crescent Society of the United Arab Emirates has signed a contract with the Tel Aviv regime in order to create an intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at Socotra Airport. Socotra is home to some 60,000 people. It overlooks the Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route that connects the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. It also has a unique ecosystem, which is already being exploited by the Emiratis. The mission reportedly aimed at collecting information from across the Gulf of Aden, including Bab el-Mandab and south of Yemen, which is under the control of forces backed by the UAE. Socotra has been a source of tensions between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. They have been jockeying for position for control of the island's unique resources in the absence of a powerful government in Yemen amid a ferocious war on the country. Back in June 2020, UAE-backed separatists of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, or the STC, took control of Socotra.
As you know, Israel has always welcomed the opportunity to have alliances within what it has considered to be the enemy camp, namely the Arabs. And in the opportunity with an alliance is to profit in various ways, to build one's power through espionage.
A new security pact involving the United States, Britain, and Australia has triggered controversy and condemnation. The U.S. and U.K. announced this week that they will provide Australia with advanced technology to build nuclear-powered submarines. Based on their agreement, Australian naval forces will have atomic submarines that are much faster as they use nuclear propulsion systems and harder to detect than conventional fleets. They can spend months under the sea and target longer distances with their missiles. The leaders of the three countries hailed the New Deal as a step that will make it easier to counter threats in the Indo-Pacific. They repeatedly mentioned regional security concerns, which they said had grown significantly. None of them mentioned China, but the pact is being widely viewed as an initiative to counter Chinese influence in the region, including in the contested resource-rich South China Sea.
Well, there are two elements here. One is the fact that this alliance could be a new version of NATO for Indo-Pacific region, and the other is that this purchase of nuclear-powered submarine could be an initial step to transfer more technology to nuclear technology to Australia, maybe in the long term having Australia acquiring nuclear bomb capacity.
The United States and its allies make no secret of their intensified efforts to try to contain the growing Chinese influence and power there. Many observers believe the newly announced deal is in line with those efforts. Meanwhile, the development is expected to further sour relations between Beijing and Canberra. In recent years, political tensions have grown between the two over a number of issues, including Australia's stance against Chinese telecom giant Huawei. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Xiao Lijian criticized what he called the U.S.-led alliance's obsolete Cold War mentality and warned the three countries against moves that would hurt their own interests. Some Chinese media went so far as to say that Australia had now turned itself into an adversary of China. What are the implications of this new pact and other moves against China for regional and international security? Meanwhile, China was not the only party infuriated by the new security pact. France condemned it too. That is because Australia will now scrap a deal with France to buy a dozen conventional submarines worth tens of billions of dollars. France's Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian called Australia's agreement with the U.S. and the U.K. a stab in the back. France said the development underscored the need to bolster a, quote, European strategic autonomy. The United States and arch-rival China may have toned down their rhetoric against each other, but tensions between the two superpowers are simmering as they remain deeply engaged in an intense global rivalry. There are many flashpoints in their testy relationship, including tensions in the South China Sea and the issue of Taiwan. America has made it clear that its military will maintain a strong presence in the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. has been trying to contain the growing influence of its arch-rival. America seems determined to follow policies aimed at containing the Chinese influence worldwide. And with China absolutely unwilling to back down, tensions are expected to mount in the coming years.
political climate created by the global war on terror after the 9/11 attacks set the stage for large increases in the Pentagon budget, much of which went to military contractors. A new article by Brown University's Cost of War Project has shed light on military spending by the Pentagon after 9/11. The Pentagon budget increased by over 10% in the first year after the 9/11 attacks and the commencement of the war in Afghanistan. The Pentagon budget untimely increased year after year for 10 years running and peaked in 2010 at the highest level since World War II.
President Eisenhower, when he was leaving office, talked about the military-industrial complex, and these are the people that supply the weapons for wars. And in order to have a war, you have to have some type of threat, and that was provided by 9/11, and they decided to cash in on that. This provided unique opportunities for stealing money.
The study says over $14 trillion was spent by the Pentagon since the start of the war in Afghanistan. The report says $4.4 trillion of the total spending went towards weapons procurement and research and development. That category directly benefited corporate military contractors. Out of the $4.4 trillion, the top five U.S. weapons makers, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman, received $2.2 trillion, almost half. Besides getting paid for weapons and research, U.S. corporations profit from private contractors that are deployed to war zones. The most notorious private security contractor previously employed by the Pentagon is Blackwater. It is a mercenary group whose employees massacred 17 people in Iraq's Nasser Square back in 2007. The Pentagon also employed private contractors for just about every task in U.S. war zones. At the end of the Trump administration, only 2,500 U.S. troops were left in Afghanistan, but over 18,000 Pentagon contractors were still in the country.
And what we saw recently was that they were, a lot of those weapons that got left behind were delivered within weeks of the end of the war. I mean, very close to pulling out, which meant that they had to unload them in order to cash in on what they were doing. They also unloaded them into a group of people who could use them to destabilize the region, which was also their intent.
The report explained how China is the new justification for military spending. As the U.S. has reduced the size of its military footprint in Iraq and Afghanistan, exaggerated estimates of the military challenges allegedly posed by China have become the new rationale of choice in arguments for keeping the Pentagon budget at historically high levels. The most likely impact of the shift towards China will be to further tighten the grip of major weapons makers like Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies on the Pentagon budget. Over the past few years, the U.S. has adopted a confrontational approach toward China. There are many contentious issues the two countries have been quarreling over.
China is much more complicated because both countries, China and the United States, are tied together economically in a way that would be very difficult to disentangle over, in short notice. The United States is dependent on China for a large bulk of its manufacturers, including crucial manufacturers like computer chips.
The U.S. accuses China of genocide against the Uyghur population in the province of Xinjiang. China has rejected the accusations, asking the U.S. to stop interfering in what Beijing considers its internal affairs. The two countries have also been locked in a trade dispute since 2018, when the Trump administration imposed tariffs on more than $360 billion of Chinese goods, and China retaliated with tariffs on more than $110 billion of U.S. products. U.S. meddling in the South China Sea and provocative speeches by U.S. officials have also angered China, with Beijing accusing Washington of being the direct driver of tensions in the region.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar!
Khomeini Rahbar and Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
شما در این قرن معجزه کردید. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Merciful, the Most Compassionate. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World and is Still Changing It. And of course, I'm referring to Imam Khomeini, this holy personality who really has changed the world forever. In the last program, I was discussing with our guest, Dr. Hassani. And before I proceed to summarize what we discussed before, I'd like to welcome once again Dr. Hassani, who is an academic and also a researcher in Islamic research. And I give him a very warm welcome to the program.
Assalamu alaikum, brother. Thank you for having me.
I discussed with Dr. Hassani, and the question was that how do we study a personality like Imam Khomeini? What's the approach? And we certainly discussed in the last session that the approach has to be not only in terms of context, but also in terms of claim. And this is what we were really getting down to, is that there is many claims that are made by many people in the world. There's a lot of claims made by the American president, and a lot of claims made by certain ideologies about the utopia which they want to create in any particular nation or in any particular time. But of course, they never live up to expectation. But Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, was much more than expectation. It was really a miracle. And that's what we're really getting down to, is that how did this miracle actually occur, both in the context of what Iran was in the early part of the 20th century. Of course, in the later half of the 20th century, we saw dramatic changes in the world. But we want to look into that analysis by the fact of the impact of what Imam Khomeini actually made on the whole world. And as we say, it is about claims. Now, I'd like to start today's discussion with Dr. Hassani on the basis that it says in the Holy Quran that why do you people make claims that they never, God says to us, that why do you make claims that you never live up to? And yet, there were claims in the past in terms of the monarchy that was there in Iran, where certain kings became shadows of God as claims. And how ridiculous was that? Tell us, Dr. Hassani, put that into some kind of context, that if that was the system by which people had to live, what were we going to expect, especially on the basis of Tawheed, when we are supposed to be, say, Laysa Kamithli Shay, that God is nothing like his creation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Again, my answer to you in one word, hallucinating.
Right, they were hallucinating, weren't
when
they?
When you think you're big.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the characteristic for...
It just simply came out of vanity.
I'll give it to you. The way Quran is teaching us, the Satan went wrong. Why? Because he thought he was big.
Yeah, he became
and this
conceited.
Is the whole, he was deceived, and he tried to deceive everybody else in between.
Yeah.
The thing is this.
He was full of himself.
Of course he was. And this is on a lighter note. If you get into that, he was something more than you could expect, because he was challenging his own creator in a negative sense.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely.
We might get
into
that.
Because he had become proud.
Exactly. The thing is this. If you're not big, according
yes.
to... According to the definition, how can you become big? Let me give you an example. In mathematics, what is the value of zero?
Zero.
Zero.
Nothing.
Zip.
Zip.
Nothing.
Nothing. Yeah.
But if you put a zero after a one, what happens?
Becomes 10.
Becomes 10.
Yeah.
10 times.
Times.
You can't say 10 times bigger.
No.
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 You see?
No, you can't do that. That doesn't work in math.
Think about this.
Yeah, yeah.
Because no matter what kind of number in math, you know, multiplied by zero is zero.
Zero.
But when you put a zero next to a one,
one,
it becomes 10. And if you put two zeros,
it's 100.
100. And the story goes on.
But the one is very important.
And that one is the oneness that the Tawhid we're talking about.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say.
So yeah. Satan, just like everybody else, just like everything else,
was
let's
zero.
Talk simple here. He was zero.
He was zero.
And he will stay zero if he did not seek a place
with the one.
When we are escaping from devil's trick, we are told to say, I seek refuge in God.
God.
From
in
Satan.
The one.
In the one.
In the one.
And one is one, no matter what. One is the creator. Okay?
Marshall. Yes, that's absolutely right.
So, the thing is this. The arrogance, and this goes with politics today. We might
absolutely.
Get to that. We
yeah.
should.
Yeah, we should.
Satan was nothing. He didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to look for greatness, bigness, which could give him all the respect, all the reward he could not even
imagine,
possibly imagine.
Yeah.
He didn't. He went astray. He went out of the way, out of order, which is the law, the do's and don'ts of what Creator put in place.
Sure.
He didn't. So he wasn't big, but he pretended. Okay?
Yes.
This is the word istikbar. Istikbar, you know, the whole claim is this, Brother Ejaz. I might, you know, I'm not trying to jump from here and there, but
no.
It's so many beautiful and different subjects attaching with the life of Imam Khomeini.
Exactly.
May his holy soul rest in peace.
Peace, yes.
It's so many different things that sometimes you feel, you know, you get so excited.
Yeah.
You want to say the whole thing in one session.
In one breath,
impossible.
But that's not possible. But that's what I was saying in the previous program.
The
that I was saying about the fact that this is the extraordinary thing about Imam Khomeini, because this is what we're really talking about, is the fact that he's multidimensional. He's not a one-dimensional
exactly.
man. So that's what we're saying. And what makes him that multidimensional man? Because as you say, there was a claim right in the dawn of time, or before the dawn of time, I should say, because we are really into the realms of the Creator here. But at that particular moment, this zero, as you said, had a big claim, but was proved to be zero at the end of the day once it was found out that he had got too big for his shoes and couldn't live up to what he was. So at the end of the day, that's what we're saying, that isn't that the sad history, isn't that the misfortune that the Muslim world has been going through?
Exactly.
That we've had people who, as you say, like Satan, came up with big claims out of vanity, out of pride, and so was the Shah.
Out of emptiness.
Out of emptiness. Made a lot of noise, but at the end of the day...
To finish the point about Satan, Brother
Ejaz,
to say this. He was nothing, but he wanted to be somebody big.
Yeah, that he wanted it.
This is why the word istikbar. Istikbar means trying so hard to look
the
big.
Part.
To look big.
Yeah.
To look great.
To look the
and
role,
you know what?
Yeah.
Okay, at this point, I should say this.
Hmm.
You know what the biggest claim of Imam Khomeini was? The claim
Please.
Shaped into the slogan of what we know as Allahu Akbar.
Yes.
God is great.
That is the claim.
When God is great, you are nothing. When you are attached with what he wants you to be, where he wants you to be, how he wants you to be, then you become big. And nobody can deal with you.
Exactly.
That's why Imam Khomeini says America cannot do a damn thing.
Because he's attached to the greatest
and
of all.
And at this point, it wasn't a slogan. It wasn't
no,
a claim.
No, that is a reality.
And that wasn't a claim. That was a reality.
That is a
that
reality.
That was a mere fact. As we speak. See?
Yeah.
You have to distinguish as we go along.
Sure.
As we proceed to talk about that great personality, so from the claim comes something that people think is claim, but
sure.
it's not.
No,
it is a slogan. It's a motto.
Exactly. So
but that's the whole thing. He lived according to his belief.
Exactly.
He wasn't.
And the belief comes straight out of the Quran.
Exactly. So and the power comes from that.
Yeah. So tell us from the Quran in terms of these claims, which, as you see, the attachment is with Allahu Akbar. And that's how the revolution started. Mm-hmm. That was the shouting on the streets.
And you know the deeper explanation of the slogan Allahu Akbar? The mere translation is God is great, which is true.
True.
But they ask Ma'asum, what does it mean?
Mean, yes, please.
He said something to the fact that Allah is greater than whatever you can imagine.
Imagine.
That's a belief.
That is something
Brother,
else.
The phenomenon, the issue of belief is a very serious one.
And Imam Khomeini proved
that. Khomeini proved that he was pro this ideology.
Exactly.
He didn't just say it. The difference between ordinary people like myself with Imam is this. Whatever he said, he didn't say it, you know.
He acted it.
He didn't say it for something to sound good.
Yeah.
To attract population.
Yeah.
He meant it. He believed it. He lived it. He lived according to his belief. So this is the difference.
Yeah,
and you see the end result. Mm. Another thing, you have a criteria, a good check and balance system you can tell by the end result. You asked me something about communism in the previous program.
Yeah.
But you see, after the demise, the collapse of Soviet Union, what happened? If somebody might ask.
Yeah.
What happened? It was that zero. But during the course of history, time... Another thing with people, you know, ordinary people,
sure,
who don't stick to Quranic teaching, a deep understanding of Islam,
yes,
what Islam wants to make out of you, this is very important.
Yes,
those who used to see the military parade in the Red Square with all how many great numbers of tanks and machineries and troops and cannons and this and that.
Missiles, yes. Ballistic
and
missile.
Every year, the whole thing was a different show.
Sure, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Showmanship. People who saw that, they thought this material, this so-called power, this is not the real power. This so-called thing could help whoever the regime might be. But we saw the end result. It didn't help. It
happened at all.
You see? This is what we're talking about. You're talking about religious in a true sense. You're talking about God commands in a true sense, do's and don'ts. The entire life of human being could be shaped, put on the right track, okay?
Sure.
If he listens to his own creator. By the way, I gave you this example in the last program.
Sure.
Only Sony can write a manual for its own product, not Sanyo.
That's right. Right.
Okay, and God is the only one who can write this manual, and he did, the perfect one, which is Quran, through his prophets. And the story goes on with Imam Khomeini. When he said that America cannot do anything, this was not a claim, this was a fact. Claim is to a certain point. When you get on the right track, you just continue to march, and you don't even look You don't look behind yourself.
That's right. And the other...
Because you believe in it. This is a straight path.
As you see, the claim was very great at the beginning of the revolution, but it was also the claim that Islam made right from the outset.
And you know the reason for claim? To call on people.
To call on people.
This is a divine duty.
Yeah. It's as you say, this claim is a reality in terms of calling people that God is great, Allahu Akbar. And then... We had in this particular context, because of course Islam has to answer to every century.
Right.
And
you know, one of the famous saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, at the beginning of Islam, at the beginning of invitation, he said, Hulu, all of you say, he didn't say Muslims say this.
No, he said all
Hulu,
of you say.
All of it, see? All. For the entire globe. La ilaha illallah. There is no
God
but him. What happens? The salvation is yours. As simple as
that.
So can you imagine one person, by the way, prophets, apostles, messengers of Allah did not see themselves as one.
No.
They saw themselves as that zero we were talking about.
Exactly. And I'm just saying that, you know, when they say, as Imam Khomeini, this great personality, put those words back on our lips again, reminding us. And this is the thing about Quran, isn't it? You go through its chapters and you're told, remember.
Let me tell you a story.
Yeah. Before you do, Doctor, just to let me finish this point, where he says that he's pointing out not the fact that, as I say, in terms of numbers, that there's no other God, that we are counting a whole range of gods. That's not what we're talking about. He's just saying that this is the only reality. And that's why this next slogan that came up in the revolution was, neither east nor west. You know?
Exactly.
So, We're not talking about
this
points
is exactly
of an compass.
Exactly like Prophet said. Yeah. Just say there is no God but Allah.
Yeah.
No east, no west. Mm. The story is this. You know, every ideology has an enemy. This is natural.
That's true.
Okay?
True.
And the ideology behind the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran is Islam. This is a fact.
Fact.
Some people don't like it. We're not going to get into the reason.
No, no.
I mean, this is natural.
This is natural.
There is not even one single government on this planet that the entire globe is agree with them.
Yeah.
Having said that,
sure.
Naturally, we have enemies. But the funny thing I'm going to refer to, you're going to get the punchline in a second.
Sure.
The thing is this. Back in a couple of years ago, during the disturbance, the least you can say, the fitna of 88, they used to use the same tool that revolutionary did against Shah, reciting the slogan of Allahu Akbar, but it backfired. A couple days ago, I saw in media that we don't believe in Allahu Akbar. Why you said it? It backfired on us. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
I make the whole story short. This Allahu Akbar, this God is great, is not from the same gender.
No.
From the same nature. It's not.
No.
So you have to believe in what you say.
Yes, that's a hypocrisy.
That's
actually
hypocrisy, exactly.
Right.
And you draw a good conclusion, a correct one.
Mm.
To say God is great, but begging U.S. government to help you out.
Help you out.
I mean, that's hypocrisy.
not quite the same.
First
Allah
of all,
Akbar, we were
the claim
about
has to be genuine.
Genuine.
You have to back it with your action.
Yes.
You have to sacrifice for it. You have to struggle for it.
Yes.
And then again, the story goes on.
Yes.
Imam Khomeini's personality of this kind. A divine man.
That's right. And because divine, meaning that he's the one who's actually waking us up to the fact that the reality is Allahu Akbar, but he himself is living every moment and every breath of his life to be with that Allahu Akbar. So in that sense, when he was saying neither east nor west,
he meant it.
He meant it.
And he did a stick behind
and,
it.
And Washington and Moscow, they also got the message that he really means it. Because the others were also saying, you know, we have the non-aligned movement. We've even got the summit happening at this very moment. What's the non-aligned movement? And that was the kind of thing that we're away from all these superpowers. But is that the reality?
You have to give him credit, the media, the Western media. I have to give him this, you know.
Yeah.
I remember back then,
I'm
talking about 30-some years ago,
sure.
They were talking about Imam Khomeini. I don't remember exactly. It was Newsweek or something, you know, explaining Imam Khomeini, what kind of personality he is, what kind of influence he had over people because of the belief.
Yeah.
You know what they said about him?
Mm.
He said, Khomeini is a person that his word is law. Think about that.
Yeah.
And that law, that validity comes from the source. Remember, in one program, we were talking about the source.
Sure.
The pure source.
Yeah.
The pure source is Quran, Quranic teaching.
Yes.
He knew Quran. He believed in Quran.
Quran.
He acted upon it.
Yes. Yes. I was going to put it in the sense that, you know, in the 50s and 60s, you know, the non-aligned movement was about as non-aligned as, you know, a skewed line drawn on a paper.
As good as it could get.
But in this context, you know, with this summit happening in Tehran, it bears witness to this great personality's effect that really and truly they've got to be neither east nor west. And they're waking up to that fact so that we're having this in the context now where people are beginning to see that there has to be some kind of alternative reality in the face of what we've been seeing since the beginning of the 20th century.
That is true. Let me explain another concept. We keep saying divine man.
Yes.
What does it mean?
Yeah.
The way I see Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him,
sure,
is from the understanding of Quran. Remember at the beginning of the creation,
sure,
God told all the angels, and by the way, Satan was not part of the angel.
No.
He was among them.
He was among them. Okay? He was an archangel by definition.
Exactly. Mm. So God is telling all the angels, you know, to begin. Mm. Said, look, I am going, listen to the word carefully.
Sure.
You have to be careful when you do a research, when you do a study, when you do a real thinking. Mm. You have to give the word its own value.
Yeah.
You don't have to distort it.
No.
You don't have to go astray. You have to carefully study the word.
Yeah.
God told him, I am putting.
You have to be precise about it.
You have to be precise about it. Especially when it comes to Quranic understanding.
Sure, sure.
He says something to the fact that inni, most surely I, God is speaking, inni ja'ilun fil arzi khalifa, I am putting, not I am going. He didn't say ja'altu or aj'alu. Ja'ilun.
Ja'ilun.
For those brothers and sisters who are familiar with the Arabic word, it tells you a news that something I'm doing right now and I'm going to continue constantly.
It. Constantly.
I am putting a khalifa on the planet. Khalifa means successor.
Successor.
Having said this, well, the angels, in my opinion, you know, this is a very delicate and sensitive issue when you talk about commentary on Quran.
Yes.
But to study these words, when they question, not in a negative way, they want to know.
Well, yeah.
When they question, why are you putting somebody on earth that constantly is going to commit
bloodshed,
sin, and corruption?
Corruption.
But if they listen carefully, they wouldn't phrase this question this way,
Wait.
Brother Ajaz.
Yes.
They would say it differently. Because God didn't say, I'm going to put somebody.
No.
Some kind of human or whatever the name might be. He said, I am putting a successor. Listen to the word, Khalifa.
Yes.
Deputy.
Deputy.
Deputy. When you deputize something, what he's supposed to do? Does the same thing that?
The God.
God wants him to do. Having said that, in order to understand Quran is more than 6,000 different verses. You have to put them in a collective way, in a comprehensive way, in a broad way, in a general. You have to put all the pieces together. This is what tadabbur, real deep understanding of Quran suggests to do that.
Yes,
in order to put them in perspective, later on in chapter Ar-Rahman, describing himself, God, remember that. He says, "Kulli yomin huwa fi shan." Every, and yom doesn't mean the 24-hour cycle.
No, no.
It doesn't mean the daylight.
No.
Kulli yom in Arabic, it means any moment.
Any moment.
Any given moment of time.
Time.
Any moment, him, the same God,
sure.
The only one.
Sure.
Huwa fi shan, he's doing something important.
My
shan. Shan is not any kind of job. Again, this is very important. Yeah. I have to repeat this.
Sure.
Then I have to emphasize, I have to underline, I have to, because I'm trying to draw
underscore
a conclusion,
it. Yeah.
To understand.
Yeah.
Okay? Kulli yawman huwa fi shan. Any given moment, Allah, is doing something important, something worth of, talking.
My goodness.
So, what the Khalifa is supposed to do, what the successor is supposed to do,
and exactly
what's
God
the
wants.
Relevant understanding of this with the life of Imam Khomeini?
Exactly.
Peace be on him.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
Is this? That when you say divine, you're not something in vacuum.
No.
You're not talking about something imaginary.
No, no.
You're not saying something, you know, to feel good.
Yeah.
No. You say that he was caring about the entire mankind. When he says no east, no west, he was doing something important. When he was telling us.
Because mankind needs a guide.
But mankind needs to be guided. To be guided on a constant basis. So kulla yawmin, as a successor, as a deputy, as somebody noble,
and
I can use so many different criteria.
And only a true successor,
a true successor
is going to enable us to do this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he was doing something important.
Sure.
You know, when that Salman Rushdie incident happened, he did something important.
Mm.
You know, something very important according to true do's and don'ts of Islam. because he knew Islam.
Exactly.
He studied Islam.
Yes.
He did his own research. He did his homework.
Yeah.
He did his duty. He was imam before. I said this before, and I have to say it again. He was imam even during the 15 of Khordad, even though we didn't call him imam.
Yes.
And the society had to go through different phases, in order to
understand acknowledge this
who's
reality.
Who.
Yeah.
To understand who's the friend, who's
sure,
not.
Sure.
Okay? And this is what we're talking about. Divine man. Yes,
divine,
he was.
Yes.
Indeed, he was.
Was.
You know, because there is a famous saying of Imam Khomeini.
Yes, I was going to get to that.
He's doing good as far as the leadership of the Islamic Republic for us.
Yes. But he says that the revolution can't be understood
without the name of Khomeini.
Imam Khomeini.
He means it. Because he was it. To give him the credit of Imam Khomeini, okay, that's another subject.
Yes.
But hey, another way to see the great people, look what kind of students they have.
They have.
You see what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, you bring me back to that beautiful moment in the school of Ahlul Bayt where Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam was met by a very competent scholar from the Muslim world who had questions, and he wanted to pose them to the Imam, but the Imam said, not that he was refusing his questions.
No need to.
No need to. He just simply said, please ask my students.
Exactly.
And if they don't satisfy you, then
you
come to me.
And Imam Khomeini says something very valuable, precious, important, and significant with regard to the personality, the great personality of Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him.
Yes.
He said that this revolution, meaning the Islamic revolution of Iran, is not known in the entire globe without the name of Khomeini.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's true. And we can talk about this again.
So thanks very much for that, Dr. Hassani. Honestly, on that note, we'll finish this session, and hopefully in the next session we're going to look at the context of Iran, particularly in terms of its region, in terms of globally.
We have to get to more issues.
More issues. And then look at, you know, again, this divine personality, how he has really impacted on the complete reversal of the role that Iran had in the past as opposed to what it is today. But thanks, listeners, for listening to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. I hope you enjoyed it, this session today.
And it
as
still
well.
Is.
And still is, as Dr. Hassani says. But I want to thank him for this session and for his valuable contribution on the program. And God willing, we'll see you in the next session very soon. May the peace and mercy of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.